Our third case for argument this morning is Lewis against Chicago. Mr. Hefner.
May it please the court, I'd like to address two issues this morning, if I can get to them. First, why my clients filed their motion to intervene in 2012. And second,
when did they first learn of the class action?
Your Honor, the different appellants learned of the class action at different points in time. Most of them, I believe Mr. Paler, Mr. Minifield, and Mr. Butler learned of the action when they entered the academy in 2005, and Mr. Ross had heard about the class action earlier. The reason they did not...
What did you say about... What was the last one?
Mr. Ross. I believe Mr. Ross had known about the Lewis class action prior to his entry into the Firefighters Academy. The reason my clients did not file a motion until 2012 was because... They always were told...
So in 2005, they knew that there was this class action on behalf of firemen?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Be a member, that they might be part of the class?
They were actually told by class counsel in 2005 that they were members of the class. They were told that orally when they entered the academy. Many people told them about a number, a hotline they could call, and they would call that number and were affirmed that they were on the list of class members.
And I gather they were, in fact, members of the class in 2005.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The class was redefined later to exclude them. Suppose we just take the standard Utah pipe approach under which the statute of limitations is told from the day the class action is filed until the day it is either not certified or amended so the person is not in the class. If you go by the Supreme Court's Lewis decision, from the time the class definition was amended, how much time remained for your clients to sue?
From the time it was amended?
From the time the class definition was amended to exclude them, how much time remained in the statute of limitations for your clients to bring independent legal actions?
Well, Your Honor, the question would be when it was amended. According to the 2005 judgment, it includes them. A 2007 injunctive order of relief does not exclude them as class members. It cuts them out of the relief. However, it does not redefine the class. In fact, the parties argued to the district court on the motion to intervene that that's what they had done, that they had come in and amended the class in 2007. The district court rejected that. She said, no, the class definition is and always has been this definition that was in the 1999 motion. Now, if we take the, the class, in this case, you have 300 days after an EEOC complaint has been denied, and assuming that my clients get to use Mr. Lewis's and the plaintiff's claim, we would say that they would have 300 days from whenever the class definition has been
modified. That's not the way Utah Pipe works. Utah Pipe is a tolling rule under which time while the class action is pending for the benefit of particular people is excluded from the statute of limitations. And then the clock begins ticking immediately thereafter. So if this suit was brought on the 299th day, your clients would have had one day exactly afterward. That's how Utah Pipe works. And that was my question. How much time was left using the method of Utah Pipe?
Your Honor, if that was the method we were going to use, I would say that my clients would have not when the class definition is actually amended by the court, but when my clients have been provided notice under Rule 23.
No, that's not the way Utah Pipe works. I mean, maybe you're just unfamiliar with Utah Pipe and can't answer my question. But the way in which it works doesn't depend on notice. It depends on the district court's decision. That's when the time restarts. That's what the Supreme Court has held.
Your Honor, I do admit I have not prepared for any questions regarding Utah Pipe or the statute of limitations with respect to my clients assuming that the class actually was amended to exclude them. American Pipe says that a class member has no duty to monitor the court record until and unless they receive a Rule 23 notice. And this court in Crawford stated that as a general rule, absent class members have no need to intervene, and in fact the time for them to intervene cannot commence until they receive Rule 23 notice. My clients never received a notice. That's an undisputed fact.
But this was a B2 class action, wasn't it?
This was a B2. This was certified as a B2 action. Under B2 does not require it as it does for B3, but in this situation it should have been sent. Just because the rule does not require it does not mean under these circumstances, when you have a class of people that you are seeking monetary relief for a past discriminatory action, if you're going to treat them differently, as this court suggested in Allstate.
When these people in 2005 learn that there's this class action of which they're members or maybe members or what have you, don't they have some responsibility to find out what's going on? I mean, the mere fact that they hadn't received notice means that when they're told about this, you'd think they would want to find out, you know, what's going on. What is this thing? Right?
Your Honor, first of all, they did. They called the hotline for the counsel, and they were told they were class members and there was nothing else they had to do. Second, under American Pipe, no, an absent class member has no duty to do anything until he finds out his lawyers aren't representing his interests. And these class members were never told that. In fact, as of today, they haven't been told that in writing. Quite the contrary, class counsel sent to my clients in December 2010 a letter that emphatically, in bold print, stated that they were class members. And later on in the letter said they had to do nothing else in order to recover in this case. In that situation, they can't be found to have needed to intervene prior to a written notice under Rule 23 that contradicted that and told them what they had to do. I see I've reached my rebuttal time, Your Honor. I'd like to save the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Sullivan.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The District Court did not abuse its discretion in denying the belated intervention in this case. In addition to constructive notice dating several years earlier, move-ins have admitted to actual notice from 2 to 15 months before they filed their motions that they would take no relief in this case. And the other factors that bear on timeliness, the prejudice to the parties, to the move-ins, and other unusual circumstances, all support the District Court's determination that move-ins did not
When you say constructive notice, what is the date on which they received that?
Constructive notice dates from the class definition in 1999 when the class was certified was those persons who had taken the test and took the test, but as a result of their test scores have been and continue to be denied. So our position is that at the moment the move-ins were hired in February of 2005, they were out of the class as it was defined from the beginning. We don't necessarily agree that the definition was later amended to exclude them. It was always time limited to people who had not had the opportunity to be hired. And when the move-ins had that opportunity and were hired in 2005, they left the class at that point, and they were on notice that they left the class in that point.
When you say on notice, what do you mean on notice?
These people all knew they were in the class. They have a very selective approach to what knowledge they think they take away from that. But
what your opponent said was they were informed when they were hired, or when they when they went to the police, to the fire school, or what?
Well, let's keep try to keep actual notice and constructive notice separate for purposes this morning because time is short. Move-ins have admitted that they knew from 2 to 15 months before they brought their motion that they would take no relief in this case.
That's not my question. So in 2005, was that when they started training to be firemen, or was that when they were actually hired?
They entered the academy in 2005.
Okay. And now, according to him, they were informed then by someone that they were members of this class that they'd heard of.
Right. But they were members of the class when the class was certified. No one disagrees with that.
So in 2005,
they left the class.
Yes, I know. But did they know about the class before 2000? Before they're hired?
We think the case was very well publicized. These are people who were very interested in the case. They made the long trip to watch the argument. They can't follow the case sometimes and not other times. But actual notice is always a substitute for constructive notice.
Yes, but I'm interested in the constructive notice.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I'm trying to answer that.
So in 2005, is it your view that because they were interested in this, and they knew something was going on, that is notice?
We think they are charged with constructive notice that when they were hired, they no longer met the class definition. And
you're being too... I don't understand you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Constructive notice. They're hired. They know there's some sort of class going on. So is it your view that they have a duty then to... inform themselves, and they would have discovered they weren't in the class, and then they could bring their own class action. Is that what you're suggesting?
There are indications pointing in different directions for whether they had constructive notice. We think they did have it, and the district court found that they did.
And the basis of constructive notice would be what?
The basis of constructive notice would be the original class definition, limiting the class to people who had not had the opportunity to be hired because
that
of their scores.
That can't be the constructive notice, the content of the document. The constructive notice would be that they should have read something or learned somehow that they weren't in the class.
Well, they were in the class. They left the class, and they had actual...
We're talking about 2005. They're hired. They're no longer in the
right.
class. Now, what is it that... They should have. What is your conception of why they should have known they were not in the class?
They should have known they were not taking relief from the judgment in this case, from the 2007 judgment itself.
I'm talking about 2005. I thought that's when you said they had constructive notice.
When they were hired, our position is they should have known that they were not.
Why should they have known it?
Because the class was limited to people who had
yes,
not.
Yes, I know, but how are they supposed to know the limitations of the class?
Well,
constructive notice. This has to be something that puts them on, they have
right.
to make an inquiry or what have you. They have to find out.
Right.
What was that?
It was very well publicized. They were hearing things. At a minimum, when they started hearing inconsistent things, we say they had a duty to inquire. And when someone is on a duty to inquire, he is charged
and
with...
Yes, I know that. And that was 2005?
That's the earliest, but you can run it much later. Our point is that when people do know, for as long as these people know, and the district court found, I know we're shifting to actual notice, but the district court made a finding of actual and constructive notice. That determination has to be overturned as an abuse of
discretion. Well, with regard to actual notice, this fellow Minifield, he had his actual notice period was very short, wasn't it?
He admits
just a few weeks.
He admits to actual notice on June 11th.
Right.
The
and
first
then in August or something.
Right. So he knows for almost 8 weeks before he files. But in our view, his is perhaps the weakest case for why he filed when he did, he admits he knew before the first motion was even filed that he might be out of the case. His lawyer, he was in touch with the movement's counsel. Everybody knew about him.
But it's you who wants to emphasize actual notice.
Correct.
Now you're switching back to constructive notice.
I'm
so
not.
So why don't we just focus on actual notice? So he gets actual notice in June, and he wakes up 8 weeks later, right?
Correct.
And that's too long, you say?
Correct.
Well, what was his deadline?
As soon as possible, particularly
when... No, be concrete. You don't like 8 weeks. What is it you think was his outer limit?
We think he should have joined the first motion. He has no excuse for not joining the first motion, which was filed 3 days after he admits to actual notice. Look,
three days? You're setting his deadline at 3 days?
The motion was being
prepared.
Is that
prepared. Your position?
The motion.
Once he got actual notice, he had 3 days.
Is that your position? Yes, Your Honor. Because he had a lawyer, he was in touch with movement's counsel before the first motion was filed. We think the second filing was wholly avoidable and wholly duplicative, and there's no reason for it. The NAACP against New York case makes clear that case involved 17 days. After notice was established. And the court says that was too long because the case was at a critical stage. And that is nowhere more true than in this case. We were 10 months into the implementation of relief in this case when the first motion was filed, 12 months into it when Mr. Minifield filed. We do say that was too long. The district court found as much. We submit that was not an abuse of discretion, and we would urge the court to affirm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. Mr. Karsh.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Joshua Karsh for the plaintiffs. With respect to Mr. Minifield, because it's an objective standard, should have known at the latest when 14 to 17 other people knew. He is in the company of others in this case, and they have all said that they knew at the latest in early 2012, or late 2011, and some of them before that. If it's an objective standard, the burden is upon him to explain why he did not know what everybody else knew. Second point, Mr. Minifield filed a declaration in this case dated June the 12th. The first motion to intervene was on June the 14th. It was brought on behalf of three people alleging no class of interveners. Mr. Minifield then did not file a motion to intervene until the very end. I think it is a completely reasonable hypothesis that what happened here is that counsel for the interveners made a strategic decision to hold Mr. Minifield in reserve to see how it went with the other three and to try on a different basis if they failed. And that's what he did. The other three all had actual knowledge. That turned out to be a big problem for them in the district court. So then he tried again on a second basis, saying, well, but Mr. Minifield didn't have actual knowledge. He could have brought the motion for Mr. Minifield on the first day. Now, Mr. Hefner also told the district court that he interviewed more than 85 incumbent firefighters. Only four of them have seen fit to actually move to intervene.
Did any similarly situated firefighters timely intervene?
None.
Okay.
None. Now, as for constructive knowledge, I think the constructive knowledge is hardest in 2005 if they don't know about the suit until they come to the academy. But it is undisputed that after 2005, they do know about the suit. That does give them some responsibility to follow and to know what's happening. In 2007, the court enters an injunction. That injunction excludes them from all relief. In 2011, the court enters another injunction. That injunction excludes them from all relief.
Now, what do you think they should have done in 2005?
In 2005, I think the case is weakest. In 2005, I think they should have come and said, are we members of the class or are we not? They say they did that. They say they called the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under Law. That is disputed. At page A163, note 1 of the record, the lawyer for the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights says that she never informed any of these people that they were members of the class if they'd been hired. So that is a disputed fact in the record. Now, the other thing that's going on here is that once a judgment, a final judgment, has been entered in a case, and two final judgments had been entered in the case before these interveners ever appeared, the district court has an understandable and justifiable right to expect some clarity from somebody who comes in as a would-be intervener. Clarity about how they mean to propose to alter or amend the judgment and what relief they seek. The district court repeatedly demanded that clarity from these interveners, and they repeatedly declined to give it. For instance, in their intervention, this is page A136, what they said in their brief was, once intervention is allowed, the parties and the court can discuss the next steps. They repeatedly refused to say where money would come from. Would it come from the city or would it come from the rest of the class? Which of the three forms of relief were they seeking? Back pay, seniority, pension, all the rest. They failed to understand until they got to this court that the seniority relief that they could seek isn't competitive seniority. It won't do them any good for anything that has to do with promotions. The last thing I see is that for 6 years now, since 2006, their union, which they think we're referring to the African American Firefighters League, we're not. Their union, Chicago Local Firefighters No. 2, has been a party to this case. Chicago Firefighters Local 2 represents all incumbents. They are incumbents. We joined the union before we got to relief in this case so that the interests of incumbents would be protected. They were not completely unrepresented in the district court. There was a union representing them.
How many of we have five people, I guess, whatever it is, four or five. How many actually were hired as firefighters and would be in the same position as the plaintiffs here, but haven't filed any suit? How many are now firefighters that were similarly situated?
That number is not in the record. The estimate that was given in the district court was 100. I think that the number is probably closer to between 150 and 200. Okay. See, my time has
expired.
Thank you,
Mr. Carr. Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Heffner?
Yes, I'd just like to correct a few things that opposing counsel said. From the minute we filed our initial motion to intervene, we alerted the court and the parties that we were going to seek to represent a subclass of these 100 or so later hired firefighters. It's not true that we did not alert the court to that. Second, Mr. Minifield was not represented by counsel when we filed our motion. Mr. Minifield had just found out about the suit 3 days prior, and we immediately alerted the court at the first status hearing about people like Mr. Minifield that had just found out about it, and immediately told the district court that if actual notice was going to be a problem, we could bring those people in if so needed. The district court didn't like that idea.
How many of those 100 or so did you notice, or did they contact you individually? You said 100 or so in similar
situations. My office has personally interviewed about 80 of those people, and it's in the record. We filed this with our first motion. The confusion among them is amazing. All of them thought that they were members. All of them thought...
Even though they were now firefighters.
Though they were now firefighters. There are affidavits in the record that say that these people called, unrebutted sworn testimony in the record, that these people called the class council. Class council told them not only that they were members, but some people asked specifically, well, you know, I'm a firefighter, I'm in the academy, or I'm getting ready to go on the job, am I still in the class? And they said yes. So these people always thought that they were in the class. They never received a notice telling them that they were not in the class. And the other issue is the 1999 definition that the city states is, and that apparently no one wants to go away from. They're all suggesting that that's the definition that applies. That is a null set definition. If that's the current class definition, nobody is in the class Not a single person. Because that definition states that to be in the class, you have to continue to be denied the opportunity to be hired, to be put in the random selection pool. In 2002, all Lewis class members were put in the random selection pool. That's how my clients got hired. That definition was inherently defective. And the only time that anyone could say that it was amended was in 2005 when the court issued its opinion on the judgment on liability, and it defined everybody who took the test as part of the class, African Americans who scored between 65 and 88, and that includes my clients. If there aren't any other questions, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.